Smets looked down at the tree. Timmy Loken was out there throwing sticks, a mindless exercise that never bored him. He was tempting fate today, getting closer than ever before, placing up sticks that had flown wide before and chucking them onto the pile around the tree. That was less work than gleaning the woods for deadwood. The nearby forest was stripped as clean as parkland. Smets thought it looked like they could set the fire any day now. In places, the wood pile was 15 feet high and you couldn't see the tree at all. What was Tully up to? This whining and giving up fit in with his behavior since their dip in the river, but the timing was suspect. We'll be ready to do the burn any day now. Why not wait till then? Screw it! It ain't going to work and you know it. Or if you don't, you're fooling yourself. You want to go home, go ahead. I'm going to stick it out and see what happens.
I said, we're going home. All of us.
Right, Smets thought. Tully was cranking up for a little screw your buddy. What you want to bet you come up outvoted 3-1, cousin?
You want to go, go.
Ain't nobody going to stop you. Tully tried a little bluster, coming on like he thought he was some kind of general.
Stuff it, Tully. I ain't no genius, but just how dumb do you think I am?
Tully waited a little too long to say,
huh? What do you mean?
That night you went chicken shit and run off to the river on us? I got to thinking about how you'd done that to me before. You ain't going to pull it on me this time, Tully.
You ain't taking off with the spike and leaving old Smed standing there with his thumb up his butt.
Tully started protesting his innocence of having entertained any such thoughts. Smeds watched Timmy Loken throw sticks. He ignored Tully. After a while, he watched fish approach from the direction of the town. The old man was carrying something over his shoulder. Smeds couldn't make out what it was. He hoped it was another of those dwarf deer like the old man had got a couple weeks back. That had been some good eating. Timmy spotted fish. He lost interest in his sticks, wandered over. It wasn't a deer fish had. It was some kind of bundle that clanked when he dropped it in front of the log. He said,
"Smell's gone over there. Thought I'd poke around."
He opened his bundle, which he had folded from a ragged blanket.
"Those guys didn't take time out to loot when they went through over there."
Smeds gaped. There were pounds and pounds of coins, some of them even gold. There were rings and bracelets and earrings and brooches and necklaces, and some of them boasted jewels. He'd never seen so much wealth in one place.
Fish said, "There's probably a lot more. I just picked up what was easy to find and quit when I had as much as I could carry."
Smets looked at Tully.
"And you wanted a cutout because the whole thing was a big bust?"
Tully looked at the pile.
Odd.
Then his expression became suspicious, and Smets knew he was wondering if Fish had hidden the best stuff where he could pick it up later. Typical Tully stall thinking. And stupid. If Fish had wanted to hold out, he would have just hidden the stuff and not said anything. Nobody would have known the difference. Nobody was interested in that town. Nobody even wanted to think about what happened there.
"What's this?"
Fish asked, glancing from Tully to Smeds. Smeds said, "He was whining about how the whole thing was a big damned bust and he was sick of it and wanted us to go home. But look here. Even if we don't have no luck with the tree, we made out like bandits. I could live pretty good for a long time on a share of this.
Fish looked from Tully to Smeds and back again. He said, I see. And maybe he did. That old man wasn't anybody's fool. He said, Timmy, you got a good eye for this kind of thing. Why don't you separate that out into equal lots?
Sure.
Timmy sat down and ran his hands through the coins, laughing.
Anybody see anything he's just got to have?
Nobody did. Timmy was good. Not even Tully found any reason to complain about his divvying. Fish said, There's bound to be more over there, not to mention a lot of steel that could be cleaned up and wholesaled if we brought a wagon up and carried it back. After they squirreled their shares, Tully and Old Man Fish headed back to town. Smeds didn't want to go anywhere near the place, but figured he had to go along to keep Tully honest. Timmy wouldn't go at all. He was happy building up the woodpile. Loot in the town made for a 10-day full-time job, what with having to clean up all the weapons and some other large items of value, and then bundling them protectively and hiding them for later recovery. They came up with enough money and jewelry and small whatnots to make a heavy load for each of them. Even Tully seemed pleased and content, for the moment. One night, though, he said, You know what bugs me? How come nobody else in the whole damned city of Orr ever got the same idea I did? I'd have bet my balls that after this long we'd be up to our asses and guys trying to glom onto that spike. Old Man Fish grunted. I've been wondering why no one's come to see what happened to the garrison. Nobody had any ideas. The questions just sort of lay there, like dead fish, too ripe to be ignored and too big to shove out of the way. Fish said, I reckon it's time we torched her and seen if she's going to do it or not. That woodpile gets any bigger, Timmy ain't gonna be able to throw them that high. Smets realized he was reluctant to take the next step. Tully didn't seem too anxious either. But Timmy had a grin on, ear to ear. He was raring to go. Tully leaned over and told Smeds,
Little Dip did some torch work back in town. Likes to see things burn.
We got a good day for it here, Fish said. A nice breeze to whip up the fire. A hot, sunshiny day, which is when we know it's asleep the deepest. All we have to do is look in our pants and see if we got some balls, then go do it.
They looked at each other a while. Finally, Smed said,
All right,
and got up. He collected the bundle of brush that would be his to throw. Fish and Timmy got theirs. Tully had to go along. They lit the bundles off down in the bottom of the hole the monster dug, then jumped out and charged the mountain of sticks from the windward side. They heaved their bundles. Tully's, thrown too far away, fell short. But that did not matter. They ran like hell, Smeds, Timmy, and Fish in straight lines, Tully zigging and zagging. The tree did not wake up before they'd all made the cover of the woods. The fire had reached inferno proportions by then. Random bolts of blue lightning flailed around. They did not come for long, though. Smeds could feel the heat from where he crouched, watching. That was one bitch of a bonfire. But he was not impressed. What he was, mainly, was sad. The fire burned the rest of the day. At midnight, Timmy went to check it out and came back to say there was still a lot of live coals under the ash, and he hadn't been able to get near it.
Next morning, they all went to look. Smeds was astounded. The tree still stood. Its trunk was charred and its leaves were gone, but it still stood, the silver spike glittering wickedly at eye level. And it did not protest their presence, no matter how close they got. That was not close enough. There was a lot of heat in the ash still. They hauled water from the river and splashed down a path. Timmy Loken volunteered to take the pry bar and go pull the spike.
I can't believe it,
Tully said as Timmy leaned on the bar and the tree didn't do anything about it.
I can't goddamn believe it. We're actually going to do it.
Timmy grunted and strained and cussed and nothing happened.
This son of a bitch ain't going to come. Oh!
It popped loose. Timmy grabbed at it as it sailed past, grabbing it left-handed for a second. Then he screamed and dropped it.
Oh, shit, that bastard is hot!
He came running, crying, and shoved his hand into the last bucket of water. His palm was mostly red and beginning to show patches of blister already. Fish took a shovel and scooped the spike out of the ashes.
Look out, Timmy. I'm fixing to dump it in there.
My hand!
Ain't good to do a bad burn that way. You head back to camp. I got some salve there that'll do you a whole lot better.
Timmy pulled his hand out. Fish dumped the spike. The water hissed and bubbled. Fish said, "You carry the bucket, Smits." Just as Tully said,
"We better make tracks. I think it's starting to wake up."
It was hard to tell against that sky, but it did look like there were tiny flecks of blue out on the ends of the smallest surviving twigs.
"The spike ain't conducting heat into the heartwood anymore," Fish said.
"Sket,"
he told the backs of a lot of pumping legs and flailing elbows. Smeds looked back just before he plunged into the woods. Just as the tree cut loose with a wild, undirected discharge, the flash nearly blinded him. Ash flew in clouds. The pain and disappointment and sorrow of the tree touched him like a gentle, sad rain. He found tears streaking his face and guilt in his heart. Old Man Fish puffed into camp one step ahead of Tully, who was embarrassed because the old-timer had outrun him. Fish said,
"We got a lot of daylight left. I suggest we get the hell on the road. Timmy, let me look at that hand."
Smeds looked over Fish's shoulder. Timmy's hand looked awful. Fish didn't like the look of it either. He stared at it, grunted, frowned, studied it, grunted again.
"Salve won't be good enough. I'm going to collect up some herbs for a poultice. Thing must have been hotter than I thought."
"Hurts like hell,"
Timmy said, eyes still watery.
"Poultice will take care of that. Smits, when you get that spike out of the bucket, don't touch it. Dump it on that old blanket, then wrap it up. I don't think anybody ought to touch it."
"Why the hell not?"
Tully asked.
"Because it burned Timmy better than it should have. Because it's a bad mojo thing, and maybe we shouldn't ought to take any chances."
Smeds did it the way Fish said after the old man went hunting his herbs. After he dumped the bucket, he moved the spike to a dry part of the blanket with a stick.
"Hey, Tully, check this.
It's still hot even after it was in that water."
Passing his hand above it, he could feel the heat from a foot away. Tully tried it. He looked troubled.
"You better wrap it up good and tie it tight and put it right in the middle of your pack."
"Huh?"
Tully didn't want to carry it himself. Didn't want it in his control every second. That was disturbing.
"You want to come give me a hand a while here?" Tully asked. "I can't never get this pack together by myself."
Smets finished bundling the spike, went over. Knowing from his tone, Tully had something he wanted to whisper. As they stuffed and rolled and tied, Tully murmured,
"I decided not to do it on the way back. We're still gonna need them a while. We'll do it later, in the city sometime."
Smedge nodded. Not saying he wasn't going to do it at all, and was going to try his damnedest to see that Fish and Timmy and he himself got fair shares of the payoff for the spike. He had a good idea what was going on inside Tully's head. Tully wasn't going to be satisfied with the big hit they'd made already. Tully was thinking Fish and Timmy made good mules. They could haul their shares back. Once they got to town, he could take them away. Smets had a suspicion Tully wasn't going to be satisfied with a two-way split either. Chapter 20. Our fire burned down till it was nothing but some patches of red. Once in a while, a little flame would shoot up and prance around for a few seconds, then die. I stared up at the stars. Most were ones I'd known all my life, but they had moved to funny parts of the night. The constellations were all askew. It was a good night for shooting stars. I'd spotted 7 already. "Uncomfortable?" Raven asked. He was watching the sky, too. He startled me. He hadn't said anything since back around lunchtime. We didn't talk much anymore.
"Scared?"
I had lost track of time. I had no idea how far we'd come or where we were, except that it was one goddamned long ways from home and down in the south. "And wondering what the hell you're doing here, no doubt."
"No, I think I got a handle on that. My trouble is, I don't like having to sneak everywhere like a thief. I might get treated like one."
I didn't add that I did not like being in places where the only person who could understand me was him. If something happened to him, that was what scared me the most. It was too awful to think about. I said, "But it's too late to turn back."
"Some say it's never too late."
So he was thinking about his kids again. Now he was plenty safe from the risk of actually having to deal with them. Also, maybe, he was having second thoughts about our ride into the unknown. Opaque as they were to me, and maybe even to him, powerful emotions were driving him. They had Darlin's name hung all over them, though he never mentioned her. One monster of a guilt was perched on his shoulders, flapping and squawking and pecking at his eyes and ears. Somehow he was going to silence that beast by catching his pal Croaker and passing the word about what happened in the Barrowland. It didn't make no sense to me, but people never do, a whole lot. Maybe the determination was starting to wear thin. It was one thing to take off after a guy expecting to catch him in a few weeks and a few hundred miles, and something else to be on the track still after months and months and thousands of miles. People aren't built to take that without any let-up. The road can blunt the most iron will. He let the edges of it show when he said, "Croaker's been gaining on us again. He doesn't have to be as careful as we do. We have to speed it up somehow, else we're going to catch him all the way to the edge of the world and still never catch him." Hell, he was talking to himself, not to me, trying to find some enthusiasm he had misplaced somewhere back up the road. There was no way we were going to kick up the pace any, not without giving up any thought of watching out for trouble from the people in the countries we were going through. We were pushing so hard now we were killing ourselves slowly. I glimpsed something off to the north.
There. Did you see that? That's what I was telling you about the other day. Lightning from a clear sky.
Hey, missed it. Maybe it's storming up there.
Just keep an eye peeled.
We watched a series of flashes so dim their source had to be way over the horizon. Usually that kind of lightning lights up or silhouettes the tops of clouds.
There isn't one cloud, Raven said. And we haven't seen one for weeks. And I'd bet we won't see any as long as we're crossing this step.
He watched another flash go. He shivered.
I don't like it, Case. I don't like it at all.
Yeah? What's up?
I don't know. Not exactly. But I got that tingle again, that bad feeling I got in Ore that set me off on this crusade.
The thing from the Barrow Land?
He shrugged. Maybe. But that wouldn't make sense. If it was really who I thought it was, he ought to be busy taking over the Empire and making himself safe from a few loose taken who might still be hanging around.
I'd had some time now to do some thinking about what might have moved in the Barrow Land and could have had so much impact on Raven.
There was only one answer that fit,
though it didn't seem likely. They had burned his body and scattered the ashes, but they hadn't been able to find his head.
If it's the Limper, we really might have trouble. Nothing he ever did made a whole lot of sense, not to us mortals. He was always crazy as a loon.
He gave me a surprised look, then a soft smile.
No sawdust between your ears, is there, kid?
All right. Put those brains to work trying to figure out why even a crazy wizard would be chasing us around the world. On the 1,000 to 1, that really is him raising a fuss up there. I laid back and started watching for shooting stars again. I counted 6 more, not really thinking about the Limper because that wasn't an idea worth taking serious. Limper didn't have no love for Raven, but he sure didn't have a grudge big enough to go chasing him neither, crazy or not.
Between a rock and a hard place.
It sort of just slipped out.
What?
Tighten up the buckles on your ego, Brother Corvus.
It ain't us he's after. If it's him.
Huh? His eyes tightened up into a suspicious squint. That made his cold, hawkish face look more predatory than ever. I had to go use that family name.
He's after the same thing we are. The Black Company.
That don't make sense either, Case.
Hell, it don't.
It's the only way you can get it to make any sense at all.
You're just not thinking about the world the way one of the Taken would.
You got a pretty screwed up eye, but you still think people is people.
Them Taken don't and never did. To them, people are just tools and slaves, live junk to use and throw away. Except for the one that was so powerful, she made them her slaves.
And she's riding with your buddy Croker, far as we know, right?
The idea sank in.
He turned it over, looked at the sharp edges, grunting and shaking like a dog shitting peach seeds.
After a while, he said, "She's lost her powers, but she hasn't lost what she knew. And that was knowledge enough to conquer half a world and tame the 10 who were taken. She'd be one big prize for any wizard who could lay hands on her."
There you go.
I closed my eyes and tried to sleep. It took me a while.
Chapter 21. The old man sat quietly. When he moved at all, he did so slowly and carefully. His status was ambiguous. He had chased these people across a continent, damned near killing himself, and for what? For nothing, that's what. For nothing. They were lunatics. They ought to be locked up for their own protection. The woman watched him from about 20 feet to his left. She was a blue-eyed, stringy-haired blonde, about 5 feet 6 inches tall, in her middle 20s. She had a square jaw, a too-broad, lumpy bottom, and a goofy manner that made you wonder if anybody was home behind those watery eyes. And for all that, there was something strongly sensual there. She was deaf and mute. She could communicate only via sign language. She was in charge. She was Darlin, the White Rose, the one who had put an end to the lady's dark dominion. How the hell could that be? It didn't add up. Off to his right was a man who watched him with the warmth of a snake. He was tall, lean, dusky, hard as a stone, with less sense of humor. These days he dressed in black, which had to be a statement of some sort, but who could tell what? He would not talk. He flat refused, which is why they called him Silent. He was a wizard himself. The tools of his trade lay scattered around him, as though he expected their unwilling guest to try something. Silent's eyes were as black as jet, hard as diamonds, and friendly as death. Damn it! A man made one mistake, and 400 years later, they still wouldn't let him live it down. There were 3 more of them around somewhere. Brothers with the surname Torque, who seemed to have no given names. They went by absurdities like Paddlefoot, Donkey Dick, and Brother Bear, except that Donkey Dick became Stubby when Darling was in listening distance, even though she couldn't hear. All 4 men worshipped her, and it was obvious to everyone but her that the one called Silent entertained romantic ambitions. Lunatics. Every single one. Something behind him yelled, "Seth Chalk, what treachery are you up to now?" And exploded in giggles. Wearily, for the 1,000th time, he replied, "Call me Bowmans. I haven't used Seth Chalk since I was a boy." He did not look around. It had been a long, long time since he had been Seth Chalk. At least 150 years. He had no exact count. It was a year since he'd escaped the thrall of a sorcery that had held him in stasis most of that time. He knew the intervening years of strife and horror, the years of the rise and growth of the ladies' empire, only by repute after the fact. He, Bowmans or Seth Chalk, was a living artifact from before the fact. A fool who had no business surviving it, who wanted to use these last unexpected gift years to expiate the guilt that was his for his part in the awakening and release of the ancient evil. These idiots were not ready to believe that, no matter that he'd damned near gotten himself killed, keeping that dragon off them during the big final throat cutting in the Barrowland last winter. Damned fools! He had done all the damage he could do in one lifetime. The 3 brothers came from somewhere up forward, joined the watch. So it was not one of them who had shouted, but Bowmans knew that. 2 of the 3 could not speak any language he understood. The 3rd managed Forsberger so brokenly it was not worth his trouble to try. The fool who could understand a little of Bowman's antiquated Forsberger could not sign. Of course. So any communication not heard directly by Silent or lip-read by Darling got garbled and lost. Only the stones communicated like regular people. They didn't like talking to rocks. There was something perverse about holding converse with rocks. The trouble with being here was that the human beings, though lunatics, were the sanest, most believable part of the furnishings. For the first time in his life, if he wanted to build cloud castles, he had to go look down. They had press-ganged him at that camp in the Windy Country. He was on the back of one of those fabulous monsters out of the Plain of Fear, a wind whale. The beast was 1,000 feet long and nearly 200 wide. From below, it looked like a cross between a man-o'-war jellyfish and the world's biggest shark. From up top where Bowman's was, the broad flat back looked like something from an opium smoker's pipe dream. Like the imaginary forests that might grow in those vast caverns, said to lie miles beneath the surface of the earth. This forest was haunted by enough weird creatures to populate anyone's fancy nightmare. A whole zoo, and all sentient. The wind whale was going somewhere in a hurry, but was not getting there fast. There had been headwinds all the way, and every so often the monster had to go down and tear up a couple 100 acres to take the edge off its hunger. The damned thing stank like 7 zoos. A couple weird characters had singled him out for relentless harassment. One was a little rock monkey, mostly tail, no bigger than a chipmunk. It had a high, squeaky, nagging voice that made him remember his long-dead wife, though he never understood a word it said. There was a shy, centauroid creature, put together backward, with the human-like part in the rear. That part of her was disturbingly attractive. She seemed intrigued by him. He kept catching glimpses of her watching him from among the copses of uncertain organs that bewhiskered the wind whale's back. Worst, there was a lone talking buzzard who had a smattering of Forsberger and a wise guy mouth. Bowman's could not get away from the bird, who, if he had been human, would have hung out in taverns, masquerading as the world's foremost authority, armed with an uninformed and ready opinion on every conceivable subject. His cheerful bigotry and who-cares ignorance drove the old man's temper to its limit. Things called mantas, that looked like sable-flying versions of the rays of tropical seas, symbiotes of the wind whales, with wingspans of 30 to 50 feet, were the most dramatic and numerous of his non-human companions. Though they looked like fish, they seemed to be mammals. They lived their whole lives on the wind whale's back. They were ill-tempered and dangerous, and they bitterly resented having to share their territory with lesser life forms. Only the will of their god contained their spite. There were dozens more creatures equally remarkable, each more absurd than the last. But they were more shy of humans and stayed out of the way. Discounting the mantas, the most numerous and pestiferous tribe were the talking stones. Like most people, Bowman's had heard tales of the deadly talking menhirs of the Plain of Fear. The reality seemed as gruesome as the stories. They were as shy as an avalanche and deadly pranksters. They were responsible for the plain's deadly reputation. Near as Bowman's could tell, what everyone else considered murderous wickedness, they considered practical jokery. What could be more hilarious than a traveler who, following false directions, stumbled into a lava pit or had his mount snatched out from under him by a giant sand lion? The stones, in the form of menhirs as much as 18 feet tall, were the stuff of 1,000 stories, hardly a one pleasant. But the seeing and hearing and having to deal with was an experience that made the stories pall, though the stones were on their best behavior now. They were under constraint, too. The stones had no language difficulties. Happily, many were a laconic sort. But when they did go to talking, their speech was sour, acidic, caustic. The lot were verbal vandals. So how the hell come they were the ones their god had made his diplomatic corps? It was no wonder the Plain of Fear was a wide-open madhouse. The tree god running it was a 24-carat lunatic. The stones were gray-brown, mostly, without visible orifices or organs. Most were as shaggy with mosses and lichens and bugs as any normal boulder that lay around, keeping its mouth shut. They intimidated the hell out of Bowmans, who liked to pretend that he was not scared of any damned thing. There were moments when he came close to blasting them into talking gravel. Weird, damned creatures. Every 100 miles the wind whale dropped till its belly dragged. Members of every species, including the Torque brothers, would start singing a merry hey-ho work song and would converge on whichever menhir had made itself most obnoxious recently. Hup, hup, over the side it would go, to the accompaniment of dire threats and foul curses. Those stones that pretended to senses of humor would yodel fearfully all the way to the ground. Damn fool crazies. No matter how the bleeding rocks fell, they always landed upright, cat-like. The show scared the crap out of the rare peasant, unlucky enough to witness it. The stones were the plains' creatures and tree god's communications lifeline. They spoke to one another mind to mind, though Bowmans was not about to give them credit for true sentience. No one would tell him squat. But he suspected Old Father Tree himself was running this operation. Whatever this operation was, from the nether end. One of those little things he found disconcerting was the fact that no matter how many stones went over the side, the menhir population never diminished. In fact, some of the same old stones turned up back abroad. Goddamned insanity!
Aye, Seth Chalk, you sour old fart. You figure out how to screw us over yet? Gah!
The talking buzzard had come. Bowman replied with a gentle, tricky gesture, consisting of wrapping his hand around the bird's neck.
Just you personally. Carrion breath.
Eyes watched. Nobody moved. Nobody took it seriously. The Torque brothers whooped it up.
Way to go, old man!
Paddlefoot gobbled in his outlandish lingo.
Tie his goofy neck in a knot!
Morons, Bowmans muttered. I'm surrounded by morons. At the mercy of cretins. Louder.
I'm going to tie your neck in a knot and braid your toes if you don't lay off the Seth Chalk and start calling me Bowmans.
He turned loose. The buzzard flapped off, squawking,
Chalk's on a rampage! Beware! Beware! Chalk's gone berserk!
I'll go to hell. Marooned with lunatics. General laughter and foolery of a sort he had not seen since his student days. But Darling and Silent neither laughed nor stopped watching him. What the hell did he have to do to make them understand that he was on their side?
Ha!
It hit him out of the blue, an epiphany. They did not distrust him, because it was he whose bumbling had wakened the old evils and loosed them to walk the earth for another dark century. He had done his part in the rectification. No. They knew what had moved his researches in the first place. His quest for tools with which to gain power. His fathomless infatuation with the lady, which had so distracted him he had made the mistakes that had allowed her to break her bonds. They might believe he had been broken of his hunger for power, but would they ever believe he was free of his thing for that dark woman? How could he convince them when he had yet to convince himself? She had been a deadly candle to many a man's moth, and the flame did not lose its attraction by being out of sight or out of reach. He grunted, prized himself off his butt. His legs were stiff. He had been seated a long time. Darling and Silent watched him amble past a stand of something that looked like pink ferns 10 feet tall. Little eyes peeped out warily. The ferns were some sort of organ. The mantas used them for an infant creche. He went as far as his acrophobia let him. It was the first he had looked overboard in a week. Last time they had been over water. He had been able to see nothing but haziness and blue all the way to undefined horizons. The air was clearer today. The view was very nearly monochromatic again, but this time, brown, just a few hints of green flecked it. Way, way ahead, there was something that looked like it might be smoke from a big fire. They had to be 2 miles high. There was not a cloud in the sky.
"Soon you will have your chance to prove yourself, Seth Jock."
He glanced back. A menhir stood 4 feet behind him. It had not been there a moment before. They were that way, coming and going without sound or warning. This one was a little more gray and mica-flecked than most. It had a scar down its face side, 6 inches wide and 7 feet long, where something had scraped through lichen and weathered surface stone. Bowmans did not understand talking stone civilization. They had no obvious hierarchy, yet this one generally spoke for them when there was official speaking to be done.
"How so? Do you not feel it, wizard? I feel a lot of things rock. What I feel most of all is grumpy about the way you all have been doing me. What am I supposed to feel? The mad psychic stink of the thing that you sensed escaping the Barrowland. From Orr. It is no farther away now."
The talking stone spoke in a dead monotone, usually. Yet Bowman sensed the taint of suspicion that lay in the menhir's mind. If he could tell the old evil was stirring from as far as Orr, when it was weak, how was it that he could not sense it now, when it was so much stronger? How was it that he, too, was alive when he was supposed to be dead? Did he know about the resurrection of the shadow because it had been one with his own? Had they conspired together and come out of the unhallowed earth of the Barrowland together? Was he a slave of that old darkness?
"It was not that that I sensed," Bowman said.
"I heard the scream of one of the old fetish alarms being tripped when something moved that should not have. That isn't the same thing at all."
The stone stood silent for a moment. "Perhaps not. Nevertheless, we are upon the thing. In hours, or a day or two, as the winds decide, the battle will be joined. Your fate may be determined."
Bowman snorted. "A rock with a sense for the dramatic. It's absurd. You really expect me to fight that thing?"
"Yes.
If it's what I think it is the thing called the Limper. And the thing known as Toad Killer Dog. Both are handicapped." Bowman sneered and snorted. "I'd call being without a body something more than a handicap."
"It is not weak, this thing. That smoke rises from a city still burning 3 days after its departure. It has become the disciple of death.
killing and destruction are all it knows. The tree has decreed that it be stopped.
Right. Why? And why us?
Why? Because if it continues amok, its course will someday bring it to the plain. Why us? Because there is no one else. All who had any great power were consumed in the struggle in the Barrowland, except thee and we. And most of all, we do it because the God has commanded it.
Bowman's muttered and grumbled under his breath.
Prepare yourself, wizard. The hour comes. If you are innocent in our eyes, you must be guilty in his.
Of course. There could be no ground in the middle, not for him. He did not have the strength to hold it. Never had had, if the truth be known, though he had deluded himself in the years of his quest for knowledge about those who had been enchained by the ancients. Did he know remorse for the horror brought on by his fumblings? Some. Not as much as he thought he should. He told himself that because of his intercession at the penultimate moment, his self-sacrifice, the outbreak of darkness had been far gentler than it could have been. Without him, the night might have lasted forever. The old man ambled away from the stone, wrapped in his own thoughts. He did not notice the stone turning jerkily, keeping its scarred face toward him. The menhirs never moved while being watched by human eyes. How they knew they were being watched, no one knew. Bowman's meander took him to the aft end of the windwell. Small rustlings accompanied him. Chaperons. If he noticed, he ignored them. They had been with him always. He settled upon a soft, unprotesting lump of whale flesh about chair height. It made comfortable sitting. But he knew he would not be staying long. The wind whale was especially fetid here. For the 100th time, he contemplated escape. All he had to do was jump and use a levitator spell to soften his fall. That was well within his competence, but not within the compass of his courage. His fear of heights was not totally debilitating. Should he fall, he would retain enough self-possession to save himself, but there was no way he could bring himself to take the plunge voluntarily. Resigned, he looked back the way he had come. Home, such as it was and had been, lay 1,000 miles away, maybe a lot farther. They were passing over lands of which he had never heard, where all who saw it marveled at the great shape in the sky and had no idea what it was. There was no guarantee he would step into friendly lands if he did go over the side. In fact, the terrain below looked actively hostile. Hell with it. He had gotten himself into this. He would ride it out. Huh. He was an old man, but his eyes were plenty sharp. The high, clean air allowed him to see a long way. And up north, at the edge of discernment, when he looked at them a fraction of a point off directly, were two dots at an altitude even higher than that of the wind whale. To be visible at all at that distance, they had to be the size of wind whales. Bowman snorted. This monster was the vanguard of a parade. He chuckled then. There were rustles nearby, the natives disturbed by his amusement. He chuckled again and rose. This time he strolled the length of the wind whale before he alighted again, as far forward as he dared go. The smoke was much nearer. It rose higher than the wind whale. He saw hints of the fires that fed the column, which had begun to develop a bend in its trunk down lower. Grim. Maybe the rock was right. Something had to be done. This was the dozenth such city, though the first they had come to still in its death throes. The progress of the insanity was an arrow pointing due south, a craziness that could make sense only to the crazy himself. The windwell began rumbling with internal flatulences. The horizon tilted, rose. Mantas piped and squealed behind Bowman's. He got a death grip on his seat. The monster was headed down. Why? It was not time to drop a menhir. It was not feeding time. Mantas hurtled past in pairs and squadrons, spade-headed darts spreading across the sky, headed toward the city and its coronet of circling carrion birds. There is a good wind running a mile below us, wizard. Bowman's glanced back. His scar-faced stone friend. If it holds, we will overtake the destroyer shortly after nightfall. You have only that long to prepare. Bowman's glanced around again. The stone was gone, but he was not alone. Darling and Silent had come to stare at the stricken city. The dark man's face was impassive, but Darling's was a study in empathetic agony. That touched the soft-headed, soft-hearted side of the old man. He faced her, said, "We will put an end to the pain, child." He spoke carefully, so she could read his lips. She looked at Silent. Silent looked at her. Their fingers flew in the speech of the deaf. Bowman's caught part of the exchange. He was not pleased. They were discussing him, and Silent's remarks were not complimentary. Bowman's cursed and spat. That bastard had it in for him for no damned reason. The mantas decimated the carrion birds, used the updraft from the fires to soar high, then returned to the windwhale carrying a feast for their young. They settled down to nap. But there was no real relaxation for anyone. The windwhale had dropped till it was only half a mile high. It passed the city, scudding along at 20 miles an hour. Soon the monster had to climb back into less vigorous air so as not to catch up before the nightfall. The scar-faced stone returned when Bowman's was not looking. When he did notice it, he said, "I feel it now, Rock. It reeks of corruption. And I still have no idea what I could do to hurt it." "Worry not. There is a new decree from the god. You are not to reveal yourself except in extreme circumstance. Our attack will be exploratory, experimental, and admonitory only." "What the hell? Why?" "Go for the kill, I say. Hit him with everything the one time he don't know we're coming. We'll never get a better shot." "The god has spoken." Bowman's argued. The god won. The windwhale began shedding altitude at dusk. Soon after nightfall, Bowman spied the campfires of an army ahead. The pair of mantas took to the air to scout. They returned, reported whatever they reported. The windwhale slanted down toward the encampment, cutting a course that would rip through its heart. Mantas poured off the windwhale's back, scrambled around and over one another in a search for updrafts. Bowman's felt the old terror moving closer. It was restless but did not seem alert. The ground came up and up. Bowman's clung to his seat and awaited certain impact, now unconcerned by the insult implicit in the fact that a dozen menhirs had moved into position around him, and Darling and her thugs were spread out, ready for trouble. The windwhale leveled out. campfire slid out of sight beneath it. The screaming down there was almost inaudible because of the creak and rumble and intervening bulk of the giant of the sky. Beaumance felt the shock of the old evil, caught completely unprepared. It went into a pure black rage. Just as it began to respond, Manta swooped in from every direction. They cut the heart out of the night with the glare of the lightnings they discharged from the store in their flesh. Bolts stabbed around by the hundred, keeping the old horror so busy guarding himself he had no chance to counterattack. The wind whale dumped tons of ballast and began a slow ascent, struggling to gain altitude against the weight of plunder. Beaumance could not see the monster's underside and was glad. Its tentacles would be grasping men and animals and anything else it considered edible. It was an intelligent beast, but it did not exempt other intelligences from its food supply if they were its enemies. Many of the plain races ate their enemies. Beaumance found the idea repugnant in practice, yet it had a certain moral allure. How vigorously would men prosecute their wars if they had to eat those who fell before their swords? Interesting. But how to impose the requirement? The mantas began returning. Near as the old man could tell, they were very pleased with themselves. It was over. The wind whale was up and safely away and now preoccupied with its digestion. Beaumance rose. Time to turn in. As he passed Darling, Silent, and the scarred men here, he said, "Next time, the bear is going to bite back. You should have stuck him while you had him." Chapter 22. The bear was stunned, numb, immobile within the desolation of his camp, desperately trying to grasp the sense of his sudden misfortune. His entire existence was a headlong assault upon adversity. Having something go sour was never a surprise. But a disaster of these proportions, with its implication of vast, previously unconsidered forces in motion, had, for the moment, obliterated his initiative. He lacked even his usual insane volition, driven by the engine of rage. The beast toad-killer dog was less stricken. Its memories of the son of the tree were fresh. It had not deceived itself when it came to that sprig's connection with its sire. It had been but a matter of time till old Father Tree showed an interest. Toad-killer dog had been to the plane of fear. He had come face to face with the god. His memories of the confrontation were not sweet. He had been lucky to escape. But that had been a profitable adventure. He had seen the plane firsthand. Now what he knew might become a useful tool, if the wicker man would listen. Unlikely. It was not now the half-rational thing that had been the limper before. It had become so self-centered, so self-involved, as to be the hub of a solipsistic universe. The beast prowled the camp, past men and the remains of men. Shock lay upon the survivors like a smothering quilt. Only a few understood what had happened. He heard mutterings about the wrath of the gods. Those men did not know how truly they spoke. It would be hard to hold them together if that theory gained credence. Problems of conscience were endemic already. There was a faint hiss, a crack, and a blinding flash. The beast's fur stood straight out. Little blue sparks pranced and crackled amidst it, though the bolt had missed. Soldiers scurried around like hens in a panic. That sniper had attained a tremendous speed, falling from several miles high. It came and went too quickly for any response. Even in daylight, there would have been little chance to get it. Flash, crack, screams. A man pranced in a shroud of will-o'-the-wisp fire. So there it was. Having made its presence known, the wind whale was embarking on a program of terrorism and attrition that would not stop till the Wicker Man proved he could stop it. Toad Killer Dog snarled at the Wicker Man till the glaze left his rheumy eyes, and he nodded once, sharply. He began to shake so hard he creaked and squeaked. He was trying to control his rage. To yield might prove fatal. One of those bolts, accurately delivered, could destroy his toy body, leaving him next to powerless, his army at the mercy of the monster above. Somewhere out there, planning around the camp, were mantas watching for a chance at the quick kill missed during the surprise attack. The shaking faded. In a controlled whisper, the Wicker Man said,
"Kill those campfires. They light us as targets."
Then he began the slow, painful process of surrounding himself with spells against the manta's bolts. Toad Killer Dog limped around, snapping and growling to make the soldiers hurry. Dousing the fires did not help. The mantas came in all night. Their accuracy did not decrease. Neither did it improve. The thing seemed more interested in harassment than killing, in keeping everyone awake and frightened of the moment the next blow would fall. It was a weakling's way to fight, though no tears fell from the sky when a bolt did splatter a soldier. The minions of the tree god were trying to panic and disperse the limper's army. That puzzled Toad Killer Dog. They were not that tender of heart. Men slipped away by twos and threes. He galloped as fast as he could on three real legs and a wooden one, yelping and nipping and driving them back, and in interim moments, trying to get a feel for that monster in the sky. Some of the deserters objected to his bullying. He had to kill a dozen before everybody got their minds right. Something familiar about a few of the lesser life sparks up there. The beast sensed the Wicker Man's summons. He trotted over. Spells now enfolded the Wicker Man in layers of protection. Pain leaked out. Toad Killer Dog was amused. The more surely the old shadow guarded himself, the greater was his pain. To make himself absolutely safe, the limper would have to subject himself to an agony that would rob him of all reason, to the point where he might not be able to get back out from behind the layered defense. The beast wondered if they knew that up there. The Wicker Man knew the answer.
"The one they call the White Rose is riding the wind whale, shaping their tactics."
Toad Killer Dog woofed in exasperation.
"The White Rose! Soft of heart, but bitterly lethal of maneuver."
It all fell into place. She had locked them into no-win positions already, without doing her conscience an injury. The limper could suffer protecting himself or ease the pain and get blown off his withy steed. They could watch their army evaporate through desertion or terrorize the men into staying and have them mutiny. And, from what he recalled of the white